This is Audible.
Audible Originals presents Caffeine, How Caffeine Created the Modern World, written and performed by Michael Pollan.
A Wakefulness Rested from Nature, How Caffeine Created the Modern World, a Botanical Success Story. Maybe the very first sentence isn't the best place to admit this, at the very moment you are deciding whether to lend me an hour or two of your attention, but halfway through the research for this story, I suffered a crisis of confidence that caused me to doubt the subject was of any interest at all, even to me, whose supposedly bright idea it was. I began seriously to doubt a long piece on caffeine was worth the time and effort it would take to report and write it, and to wonder why I had ever thought otherwise. I was in trouble. We were in trouble. Though you have an option I do not, you at least can stop right here. Before this crisis, I had been chugging merrily along, conducting interviews, reading countless books of science. It turns out caffeine is one of the most studied psychoactive compounds there is, and history, the course of which was shifted decisively in the West by caffeine, traveling to South America to visit a coffee finca, tasting all manner of caffeinated beverages, when suddenly, like the roadrunner in the cartoon, I chanced to glance down and realized there was no more road underfoot, just a vast, empty expanse of pointlessness as far as I could see. What in the world was I doing? Or perhaps it would be more accurate to ask, what was I not doing? Because something was going on with me just then that almost certainly accounts for this project's sudden loss of cabin pressure. I had stopped using caffeine, abruptly and completely. After years of a tall morning coffee, followed by several glasses of green tea through the day, and the occasional cappuccino after lunch, I had quit caffeine, cold turkey. It was not something I particularly wanted to do, but I had come to the reluctant conclusion that the story demanded it. Several of the experts I was interviewing had suggested I really couldn't understand the role of caffeine in my life, its invisible yet pervasive power, without getting off it, and then, presumably, getting back on. Roland Griffiths, one of the world's leading researchers on mood-altering drugs, and the man most responsible for getting the diagnosis of caffeine withdrawal included in the DSM-5, the Bible of Psychiatric Diagnoses, told me he hadn't begun to understand his own relationship to caffeine until he stopped using it and conducted a series of self-experiments. He urged me to do the same. The idea here is that you can't possibly describe the vehicle you're driving without first stopping, getting out, and taking a good look at it from outside. This is probably the case with all psychoactive drugs, but is especially true of caffeine, since the particular quality of consciousness it sponsors in the regular user feels not so much altered or distorted as normal and transparent. Indeed, for most of us, to be caffeinated to one degree or another has simply become baseline human consciousness. Something like 90% of humans ingest caffeine regularly, making it the most widely used psychoactive drug in the world, and the only one we routinely give to children, commonly in the form of soda. It's so pervasive that it's easy to overlook the fact that to be caffeinated is not baseline consciousness, but, in fact, is an altered state. It just happens to be a state that virtually all of us share, rendering it invisible. So I decided that for the good of the peace, that is to say, for you, dear listener, I would conduct a self-experiment in abstention. What had never occurred to me when I began this experiment is that, by giving up caffeine, I would be undermining my ability to tell the story of caffeine, a knot I wasn't at all sure how to untie. Maybe I should have anticipated the problem. The scientists have spelled out, and I had duly noted, the predictable symptoms of caffeine withdrawal: headache, fatigue, lethargy, difficulty concentrating, decreased motivation, irritability, intense distress, loss of confidence, and dysphoria, that is, the polar opposite of euphoria. I had them all to one degree or another, but beneath the deceptively mild rubric of difficulty concentrating hides nothing short of an existential threat to the work of the writer. How can you possibly expect to write anything when you can't concentrate? That's pretty much all writers do. Take the blooming multiplicity of the world and our experience of it, literally concentrate it down to manageable proportions, and then force it through the eye of a grammatical needle, one word at a time. It's a miracle anyone ever manages this mental feat, or at least it seems that way on day 3 of caffeine withdrawal. But even before the writer can hope to confront and scale that sheer cliff of impossibility, he or she needs to muster the confidence, the sense of agency and power required to proceed. It hardly matters if it's a delusion, but that sense that you have by the tail a story the world needs to hear, and you alone have what it takes to tell it, is precisely what you need to tell it. Forgive the masculine metaphor, but much depends on this mental tumescence. What I discovered is that it, in turn, depends in no small part on 1,3,7-trimethylxanthine, the tiny organic molecule known to most of us as caffeine. The first day of my withdrawal, which began on April 10th, was by far the most trying, so much so that the prospect of writing, or even just reading, was immediately rendered futile. I had postponed the dark day as long as I could, concocting the kind of excuses every addict does. Stressful week coming up, I would inform myself. Probably not the best time to go cold turkey. Of course, there was never a good time to do it. Always some reason I needed to be sharp and couldn't afford the flu-like symptoms the researcher said might be in my future. I want to do right, as country singer Gillian Welch crooned, but not right now. That was me, day after day. Procrastination at the beginning of any writing project is not unusual for me, but this went on for weeks. Eventually, however, I found myself cornered by the fact that there was no more reporting to be done, and all that stood between me and sitting down to write was quitting coffee, the very act that would render it impossible to write. I set a date and determined to stick to it. April 10th, a Wednesday morning, arrived. According to the researchers I'd interviewed, the process of withdrawal had actually begun overnight while I was sleeping, during the trough in the graph of caffeine's diurnal effects. The day's first cup of tea or coffee acquires most of its power, its joy, not so much from its euphoric and stimulating properties than from the fact it is suppressing the emerging symptoms of withdrawal. This is part of the insidiousness of caffeine. Its mode of action or pharmacodynamics mesh so perfectly with the rhythms of our body so that the morning cup of coffee arrives just in time to head off the looming mental distress set in motion by yesterday's cup of coffee. Daily, caffeine proposes itself as the optimal solution to the problem caffeine creates. How brilliant. Judith and my morning ritual after breakfast and exercise at home involves a half-mile walk to coffee, as the real estate brokers now like to say. For some reason, we never make coffee at home. Instead, we buy a cup at the Cheese Board, a local bakery and cheese shop, and sip it from a cardboard container swaddled in a warm cardboard sleeve. Wasteful, I know. Hoping to fool myself, I made sure to keep everything about the morning ritual unchanged. The walk down the hill and the hot drink in a swaddled cardboard cup, except that when I reached the register, I forced myself to ask for a mint tea instead of the usual large half-calf. Yes, I was a comparative piker in my coffee consumption. After years of the usual, this raised the barista's eyebrows. "I'm on the wagon," I explained apologetically. On this morning, that lovely dispersal of the mental fog that the first hit of caffeine ushers into consciousness never arrived. The fog settled over me and would not budge. It's not that I felt terrible, I never got a serious headache, but all day long I felt a certain muzziness, as if a veil had descended in the space between me and reality, a kind of filter that absorbs certain wavelengths of light and sound. I wrote in my notebook, "Consciousness feels less transparent than usual, as if the air is slightly thicker and seems to be slowing everything down, including perception." I was able to do some work, but distractedly. "I feel like an unsharpened pencil," I wrote. "Things on the periphery intrude and won't be ignored. I can't focus for more than a minute. Is this what it's like to have ADD? By noon, I was mourning the passing of caffeine from my life for an unspecified period of time. I so missed what Judith calls her cup of optimism, the same cup that Alexander von Humboldt, the great German naturalist, called concentrated sunshine. Humboldt had a parrot named Jacob who could say only one thing, "More coffee, more sugar." Though at this point, I would have settled for much less than optimism. "What I miss," I wrote, is nothing resembling a state of intoxication or euphoria, just the simple gift of my normal everyday consciousness. Is this the new baseline? God, I hope not. Over the course of the next few days, I definitely began to feel better. The veil lifted, yet I was still not quite myself, and neither quite was the world. By the end of the week, I had gotten to the point where I didn't think I could fairly blame caffeine withdrawal for my mental state and disappointing output. And yet in this new normal, the world seemed duller to me. I seemed duller too. Mornings were the worst. I came to see how integral caffeine is to the daily work of knitting ourselves back together after the fraying of consciousness during sleep. That reconsolidation of self, the daily sharpening of the mental pencil, took much longer than usual and never felt quite complete. I began to think of caffeine as an essential ingredient for the construction of the ego. Mine was now deficient in that nutrient, which perhaps explains why the whole idea of writing this piece, indeed of ever writing anything ever again, had come to seem insurmountable. I've been talking here about a chemical, caffeine, but of course we're really talking about a plant, or in this case two plants, Coffea and Camellia sinensis, aka tea, that over the course of their evolution figured out how to produce a chemical that happens to addict most of the human species. This is an astounding accomplishment, and while that was not the plant's intent in concocting this molecule, there is no intent in evolution, just lots of blind chance that occasionally yields an adaptation so good that it is extravagantly rewarded. Once that molecule found its way into the human brain, the destiny of those plant species and this animal species changed in momentous ways. The adaptation proved so ingenious that it allowed the plants to wildly expand their numbers and habitats. In the case of Coffea, whose range had previously been limited to a few corners of East Africa and Southern Arabia, its appeal to our species allowed it to circumnavigate the planet, colonizing a broad band of territory, mainly in the tropical highlands, that reached from Africa to East Asia, Hawaii, Central and South America, and now covers more than 27 million acres. The path of Camellia sinensis has taken the plant from its origins in southwest China, near present-day Myanmar and Tibet, as far west as India and east to Japan, colonizing more than 10 million acres. These are two of the world's most successful plants, right up there with the edible grasses, rice, wheat, and corn. Yet compared to those species, which won our support by so admirably supplying our need for calories, tea and coffee's ticket to world domination involves something much more subtle and superfluous, their ability to change our consciousness in desirable and useful ways. And unlike the edible grasses, the fat seeds of which we consume with virtually every meal, all we want from the tea and coffee plants are the molecules of caffeine and some characteristic flavors we extract from their leaves and seeds, respectively. So all we do with them is trivially lighten the weight of their vast biomass before simply dumping it all in landfills. Tons of these most valuable of all agricultural commodities are shipped from the tropics to the higher latitudes, there to be briefly soaked in hot water and then thoughtlessly discarded. Isn't there something ecologically absurd about this? Coffee and tea had their own reasons for producing the caffeine molecule, and as is often the case for the so-called secondary metabolites produced by plants, this is for defense against predators. At high doses, caffeine is lethal to insects. Its bitter flavor may also discourage them from chewing on the plants. Caffeine also appears to have herbicidal properties and may inhibit the germination of competing plants that attempt to grow in the zone where seedlings have taken root or later drop their leaves. Many of the psychoactive molecules plants produce are toxic, but as Paracelsus famously said, the dose makes the poison. What kills at one dose may do something more subtle and interesting at another. The interesting question is why so many of the defense chemicals produced by plants are psychoactive in animals at less than lethal doses. One theory holds that the plant doesn't necessarily want to kill its predator, only disarm it. As the long history of the plant defense chemical versus insect arms race demonstrates, killing your predator outright isn't necessarily the best move, since it will quickly select for pesticide-resistant members of that species, eventually rendering the toxin harmless. Whereas if you succeed in merely discombobulating your enemy, distracting him from his dinner, say, or ruining his appetite, as many psychoactive compounds will do, you might be better off, since you will save yourself while preserving the power of your defense toxin. Caffeine does, in fact, shrink the appetite and discombobulate insect brains. In a famous experiment conducted by NASA in the 1990s, researchers fed a variety of psychoactive substances to spiders to see how they would affect their web-making skills. The caffeinated spiders spun a strangely cubist and utterly ineffective web, with oblique angles, openings big enough to let small birds through, and completely lacking in symmetry or a center. The web was far more fanciful than the one spun by spiders given cannabis or LSD. Intoxicated insects are also, like intoxicated humans, more likely to do reckless things, thereby attracting the attention of birds and other predators who will happily do the plant's bidding by snatching and destroying the helplessly dancing or stumbling bug. Most of the various plant chemicals or alkaloids that people have used to alter the textures of consciousness are chemicals originally selected for defense. Yet even in the insect world, the dose makes the poison, and if the dose is low enough, a chemical made for defense can serve a very different purpose: to attract and secure the enduring loyalty of pollinators. This appears to be what's going on between bees and certain caffeine-producing plants in a symbiotic relationship that may have something important to tell us about our own relationship to caffeine. The story begins in the 1990s when German researchers made the surprising discovery that several classes of plants, including not only coffee and tea, but also the citrus family, produce caffeine in their nectar, a substance that evolved to attract rather than repel insects. Was this an accident, a leaking of caffeine from other parts of the plant? Or could it be a slightly diabolical adaptation? When Geraldine Wright stumbled on the German paper, she was a young lecturer, a botanist turned entomologist at Newcastle University in England. "We had no idea why caffeine was in the nectar," Wright told me. So in 2013, Wright, who now teaches in the zoology department at Oxford, conducted a simple, inexpensive experiment to find out. She trapped a bunch of honeybees and immobilized them in little bee straitjackets, arranging them in a grid of bee-sized, roofless apartments with only their heads poking out on top. Using a medicine dropper, Wright fed her bees various mixtures of sugar water with and without different concentrations of caffeine. Each time she offered a bee a drop of pseudo-nectar, she gave them a little puff of a scent. The idea was to see how quickly they learned to associate that scent with a desirable food source. "Really simple, low-tech, no funding," she said, describing the rudimentary setup. "Okay, but how do you determine a bee's food preferences?" "That's simple too," Wright said. "They extend their mouth parts and proboscis if they want something." Wright discovered that her bees were more likely to remember the odor associated with the caffeinated nectar over the odor associated with sucrose only. Her results appeared in an article published in Science in 2013 called "Caffeine in Floral Nectar Enhances a Pollinator's Memory of Reward." Even at concentrations too small for the bees to taste, the presence of caffeine helped them to quickly learn and recall a particular scent and to favor it. You can see why this would be valuable to a flower. It would cause the pollinator to remember that flower and return to it more avidly. Or as the entomologist put it in the paper, caffeinated nectar increases pollinator fidelity, otherwise known as floral constancy. Drug your pollinator with a low dose of caffeine, and she will remember you and come back for more, choosing you over other plants that don't offer the same buzz. Actually, we don't know whether the bees feel anything when they ingest caffeine, only that the chemical helps them to remember, which, as we will see, caffeine appears to do for us too. Subsequent experiments with bigger budgets and more elaborate setups involving fake flowers in more naturalistic settings have replicated Wright's discovery. Bees will remember and return more reliably to flowers that offer them caffeinated nectar. What's more, the power of this effect is so great that bees will continue to return to those flowers even when there is no nectar left. An experiment conducted by Margaret J. Cuvillon and published in Current Biology in 2015 raised the cui bono question. Who benefits more from this coevolutionary arrangement between pollinators and caffeine-producing plants? it would appear to be the plant. Cuvillon demonstrated that the memory and enthusiasm of the bees for caffeinated flowers was such that it increased, quote, foraging frequency, waggle dance probability and frequency, and persistency and specificity to the forage location, resulting in a quadrupling of colony-level recruitment. That is, she estimated that four times as many bees would pay visits to the caffeinated flowers than to flowers offering nectar only. Yet the bees' exuberance exceeds any conceivable benefit to them, making it irrational. Quote, caffeine causes bees to overestimate forage quality, tempting the colony into suboptimal foraging strategies, likely to, quote, reduce honey storage, since they kept returning to the caffeinating flowers long after they'd been depleted of nectar. She concluded that this makes, quote, the relationship between pollinator and plant less mutualistic and more exploitative. The plant's offer of caffeine to the bees is, quote, akin to drugging, where the pollinator's perception of the forage quality is altered, which in turn changes its individual behaviors. It's an eerily familiar story. A credulous animal duped by a plant's clever neurochemistry into acting against its interests. An uncomfortable question arises. Could we humans be in the same boat as those hapless bees? Have we too been duped by caffeinated plants, not only to do their bidding, but to act against our interest in the process? Who's getting the best of our relationship with the caffeine-producing plants? There are a few different ways to attack this question, but a good one is to attempt to answer a second related question. Has the discovery of caffeine by humans been a boon or a bane to our civilization? And what about to our species, which might not be quite the same thing? In the case of caffeine, we can look to recorded history for answers, since humanity's acquaintance with caffeine is surprisingly recent. Hard as it is to imagine, Western civilization was innocent of coffee or tea until the 1600s. As it happens, coffee, tea, and chocolate, which also contains caffeine, arrived in England during the same decade, the 1650s, so we can gain some idea of the world before caffeine and after. Coffee was known in East Africa for a few centuries before that. It's believed to have been discovered in Ethiopia around 850 AD, but it does not have the antiquity of other psychoactive substances, such as alcohol or cannabis or even some of the psychedelics like psilocybin or ayahuasca, which have played a role in human culture for millennia. Tea is somewhat older than coffee, having been discovered in China and used as a medicine since at least 1000 BC, though tea wasn't popularized as a recreational beverage until the Tang Dynasty, between 618 and 907 AD. It is hardly an exaggeration to say that the arrival of caffeine in Europe changed everything. That sounds hyperbolic, I know, and we often hear something similar about other developments in material culture, how the discovery of X or Y, a new world commodity, say, or some invention or discovery, made the modern world. This usually means that the advent of X or Y had a transformative effect on economics or everyday life or the standard of living. But like the caffeine molecule itself, which rapidly reaches virtually every cell of the body that ingests it, the changes wrought by coffee and tea occurred at a more fundamental level, at the level of the human mind. Coffee and tea ushered in a shift in the mental weather, sharpening minds that had been fogged by alcohol, freeing people from the natural rhythms of the body and the sun, thus making possible whole new kinds of work, and arguably new kinds of thought, too. Having brought what amounted to a new form of consciousness to Europe, caffeine went on to influence everything from global trade to imperialism, the slave trade, the workplace, the sciences, politics, social relations, arguably even the rhythms of English prose. The story goes that the human engagement with the coffee plant begins with an observant goat herder in present-day Ethiopia, one of a handful of places in Africa where the shrubby tree grows wild. According to the story, a 9th century herder by the name of Kaldi noticed how his goats would behave erratically and remain awake all night after eating the red berries of the Coffea arabica plant. Caldi shared his observation with the abbot of a local monastery, who concocted a drink with the berries and discovered the stimulating properties of coffee. Perhaps, but we do know that by the 15th century, coffee was being cultivated in East Africa and traded across the Arabian Peninsula. Initially, the new drink was regarded as an aid to concentration and used by Sufis in Yemen to keep them from dozing off during their religious observances. Tea, too, started out as a kind of spiritual no-doze for Buddhist monks striving to stay awake through long stretches of meditation. Within a century, coffee houses had sprung up in cities across the Arab world. In 1570, there were more than 600 of them in Constantinople alone, and they spread north and west with the Ottoman Empire. These new public spaces were hotbeds of news and gossip, as well as places to gather for performances and games. Coffee houses were comparatively liberal institutions, where the conversation often turned to politics, and at various times, governmental and clerical powers that be attempted to close them down, but never for long or with much success. A vat of coffee was put on trial in Mecca in 1511 for its dangerously intoxicating effects. However, its conviction and subsequent banishment was quickly overturned by the Sultan of Cairo. As coffee's defenders rightly pointed out, the beverage is nowhere mentioned in the Quran. Coffee thus offered the Islamic world a suitable alternative to alcohol, which is specifically prescribed in the Quran, and it came to be known as kaveh, which, loosely translated, means wine of Araby. This notion that coffee somehow exists in opposition to alcohol would persist in both the East and the West and comes down to us today in the common but erroneous belief that black coffee is an antidote for drunkenness. The Islamic world at this time was in many respects more advanced than Europe in science and technology and learning. Whether this mental flourishing had anything to do with the prevalence of coffee and prohibition of alcohol is difficult to prove, but as the German historian Wolfgang Schivelbusch has argued, the beverage, quote, seemed to be tailor-made for a culture that forbade alcohol consumption and gave birth to modern mathematics. In China, the popularity of tea during the Tang Dynasty also coincided with the Golden Age, and the far-reaching impact of caffeine's arrival in Europe gives the idea of a causal link some plausibility. Europeans had long been fascinated by the exotic practices of the quote-unquote Orient, and the drinking of this inky hot beverage soon sparked their curiosity. A Venetian traveler to Constantinople in 1585 noted that the locals, quote, are in the habit of drinking in public in shops and in the streets, a black liquid boiling as they can stand it, which is extracted from a seed they call kaveh and is said to have the property of keeping a man awake. The notion of drinking any beverage piping hot was itself exotic, and in fact, this proved to be one of the most important gifts of both coffee and tea to humanity. The fact that you needed to boil water to make them meant that they were the safest thing a person could drink. Before that, it had been alcohol, which was more sanitary than water, but not as safe as tea or coffee. The tannins in all these beverages also have antimicrobial properties. The contribution of coffee and tea to public health might help explain why societies that embraced the new hot drinks tended to thrive as microbial diseases declined. In 1629, the first coffee houses in Europe, styled on the Arab model, popped up in Venice, and the first such establishment in England was opened in Oxford in 1650 by a Jewish immigrant known as Jacob. They arrived in London shortly thereafter and proliferated virally. Within a few decades, there were thousands of coffee houses in London. At their peak, one for every 200 Londoners. We think of England as a tea culture, but it was coffee that flourished there first. It wasn't until the 18th century that tea consumption surpassed that of coffee, a development that had less to do with any shift in popular taste than the fact that the British Empire lacked colonies suitable for growing coffee, making it more expensive than tea. As in the Islamic world, in Europe, coffee was mainly consumed in public coffee houses, vibrant meeting places where the news of the day, political, financial, and cultural, was as much the draw as the coffee. Coffee houses became uniquely democratic public spaces. In England, they were the only such spaces where men of different classes could mix. Anyone could sit anywhere, but only men, at least in England, a fact that led one wag to warn that the popularity of coffee, quote, put the whole race in danger of extinction. Women were welcome in French coffee houses. Compared to taverns, coffee houses were also notably civil places where, if you started an argument, you were expected to buy a round for everyone. To call the English coffee house a new kind of public space doesn't quite do it justice. It represented a new kind of communications medium, one that just happened to be made of brick and mortar rather than electricity and wires. These rooms served as the internet of their time, spaces Londoners went to share and consume news and information, as well as rumor and gossip. You paid a penny for the coffee, but the information, in the form of newspapers, books, magazines, and conversation, was free. Coffee houses were often referred to as penny universities. After visiting London coffee houses, a French writer wrote that, quote, "You have all manner of news there. You have a good fire, which you may sit by as long as you please. You have a dish of coffee. You meet your friends for the transaction of business, and all for a penny if you don't care to spend more." London's coffee houses were distinguished one from another by the professional or intellectual interests of their patrons, which eventually gave them specific institutional identities. So, for example, merchants and men with interests in shipping gathered at Lloyd's Coffee House. Here you could learn what ships were arriving and departing and buy an insurance policy on your cargo. Lloyd's Coffee House eventually became the insurance brokerage Lloyd's of London. Similarly, the London Stock Exchange had its roots in the trades conducted at Jonathan's Coffee House. Learned types and scientists, known then as natural philosophers, gathered at the Grecian, which became closely associated with the Royal Society. Isaac Newton and Edmund Halley debated physics and mathematics here and supposedly once dissected a dolphin on the premises. Tom Standage, author of A History of the World in Six Glasses, three of which contain caffeine, coffee, tea, and cola, writes that coffee houses, quote, provided an entirely new environment for social, intellectual, commercial, and political exchange, making those in London what he calls, quote, the crucibles of the scientific and financial revolution that shaped the modern world. Meanwhile, the literary set gathered at Will's and at Button's in Covent Garden, where you might bump into John Dryden or Alexander Pope. Pope's The Rape of the Lock is steeped in the culture and particularly the gossip of the coffee house. And in Canto 3, pays homage to the power of the brew, quote, which makes the politician wise. It also supplied an important plot point. It was coffee that, quote, sent up in vapors to the baron's brain, new stratagems, the radiant lock to gain. Some critics maintain that the culture of the coffee house altered English prose in enduring ways. Habitués like Henry Fielding, Jonathan Swift, Daniel Defoe, and Lawrence Stern brought the rhythms of spoken English into their prose, marking a radical turn from the formality of previous English prose stylists. Specialized though they were by field of interest, London's coffee houses were also linked by patrons who spent the day moving from one to another, carrying news but also rumors and gossip, which spread more quickly through London's network of coffee houses than by any other medium. One of England's earliest magazines, The Tatler, began its life in the Grecian in 1709 and was itself an attempt to translate the sheer variety of London's coffee house culture to the page. The magazine was divided into sections, each covering a different subject and named for the coffee house associated with that particular interest. As Richard Steele, the Tatler's editor, explained in an early issue, quote, "All accounts of gallantry, pleasure, and entertainment shall be under the article of White's Chocolate House, poetry under that of Will's Coffee House, learning under the title of Grecian, foreign and domestic news, you will have it from St. James Coffee House." Not everyone in 17th century England approved of coffee or the coffee house. Medical men debated the beverage's healthfulness in fevered tracts, and women objected to the amount of time men were spending in coffee houses. In a pamphlet titled The Women's Petition Against Coffee, the authors suggested that the enfeebling liquor robbed men of their sexual energies, making them, quote, as unfruitful as those deserts whence that unhappy berry is said to be brought. The conversation in London's coffee houses frequently turned to politics in vigorous exercises of free speech that disturbed the government, especially after the monarchy was restored in 1660. Charles II, worried that plots were being hatched in coffee houses, decided that the places were dangerous fomenters of rebellion the crown needed to suppress. In 1675, the king moved to close down the coffee houses on the grounds that, quote, false, malicious, and scandalous reports emanating therefrom were a, quote, disturbance of the quiet and peace of the realm. But it was too late to turn back the tide of caffeine. By then, the coffee house was such a fixture of English culture and daily life, and so many eminent Londoners were addicted to caffeine, that everyone simply ignored the king's order and went on drinking coffee. Afraid to test his authority and find it wanting, the king quietly backed down. In France, too, coffee houses became synonymous with sedition and would play a decisive role in the events of 1789. Jules Michelet wrote that those, quote, who assembled day after day in the Café de Procope saw, with a penetrating glance in the depths of their black drink, the illumination of the year of the revolution. Perhaps for this reason, Paris's coffee houses were rife with intrigue. The mob that ultimately stormed the Bastille assembled in the Café de Foy, roused to action by the eloquence of political journalist Camille Desmoulins and intoxicated not by alcohol, but by caffeine. It's hard to imagine that the sort of political, cultural, and intellectual ferment that bubbled up in the coffee houses of both France and England would ever have developed in a tavern. If alcohol fuels our Dionysian tendencies, coffee nurtures the Apollonian. Early on, people recognized the link between the rising tide of rationalism and the fashionable new beverage. Henceforth is the tavern dethroned, Michelet wrote, surely overstating the case. Wine and beer did not go away, yet the European mind had been pried loose from alcohol's grip, freeing it for the new kinds of thinking that caffeine helped to foster. You can argue what came first, but the kind of magical thinking that alcohol sponsored in the medieval mind began in the 17th century to yield to a new spirit of rationalism and, a bit later, Enlightenment thinking. Continues Michelet, quote, coffee, the sober drink, the mighty nourishment of the brain, which, unlike other spirits, heightens purity and lucidity, coffee which clears the clouds of the imagination and their gloomy weight, which illumines the reality of things suddenly with the flash of truth. To see lucidly the reality of things, this was, in a nutshell, the rationalist project. Coffee became, along with the microscope, telescope, and the pen, one of its indispensable tools. But unlike the others, this was a tool that was taken up in the brain and mind. Wolfgang Schivelbusch writes in his wonderful history of stimulants and intoxicants, Tastes of Paradise, that, quote, with coffee, the principle of rationality entered human physiology, transforming it to conform with its own requirements. The enthusiasm for coffee among intellectuals in both England and France reflected, perhaps, its novelty as much as its power. New drugs always seem miraculous, and for that reason are often credited with astounding properties and consumed to excess. Voltaire was a fervent advocate for coffee and supposedly drank as many as 72 cups a day. Coffee and coffee houses fueled heroic labors in the Enlightenment writers. Denis Diderot compiled his magnum opus while imbibing caffeine at the Café de Procope. It's safe to say his encyclopedia would never have gotten finished in a tavern. Honoré de Balzac was convinced his vast literary output, as well as the operations of his imagination, depended on heroic doses of coffee, consumed through the night as he chronicled the human comedy in his innumerable novels. Eventually, he developed such a tolerance for caffeine that he dispensed altogether with the diluting effects of water, developing his own unique method of administering the drug dry, and I quote, I have discovered a horrible, rather brutal method that I recommend only to men of excessive vigor. It is a question of using finely pulverized, dense coffee, cold and anhydrous, consumed on an empty stomach. This coffee falls into your stomach, a sac whose velvety interior is lined with tapestries of suckers and papillae. The coffee finds nothing else in the sac, and so it attacks these delicate and voluptuous linings. Sparks shoot all the way up to the brain. The effect for Balzac was to transform the brain into a pitched mental battleground where the epic forces of his imagination could contend. Quote, from that moment on, everything becomes agitated. Ideas quick march into motion like battalions of a grand army to its legendary fighting ground, and the battle rages. Memories charge in, bright flags on high, the cavalry of metaphor deploys with a magnificent gallop. The artillery of logic rushes up with clattering wagons and cartridges. On imagination's orders, sharpshooters sight and fire. Forms and shapes and characters rear up. The paper is spread with ink. Perhaps not surprisingly, it was Balzac who wrote one of the all-time best descriptions of how it feels to be over-caffeinated, a state which he said, quote, produces a kind of animation that looks like anger. One's voice rises, one's gestures suggest unhealthy impatience, one wants everything to proceed with the speed of ideas, one becomes brusque, ill-tempered about nothing. One assumes that everyone else is equally lucid. A man of spirit must therefore avoid going out in public. It is one thing to live in a shared culture of caffeine, in which everyone's mind is running at more or less the same accelerated pace. But it's quite another to find yourself so sped up mentally that other people appear to you like motionless figures on a train platform as you blur by them in caffeinated clouds of impatience. Balzac's account of caffeine intoxication hit home as I approached the third month of my abstention. I felt very much like that stationary figure on the platform, catching envious glimpses of coffee drinkers through the train window as they streaked by. After a few weeks, the mental impairments of withdrawal had subsided, and I could once again think in a straight line, hold an abstraction in my head for more than 2 minutes, and shut peripheral thoughts out of my field of attention. My confidence in telling this story gradually returned, and after a month I could write again. You can judge how well that's going, but at least it's going. Yet I continue to feel like I'm mentally just slightly behind the curve, especially when in the company of coffee and tea drinkers, which of course is all the time and everywhere. In college, I dated a woman who had grown up without a television set in her home. She missed so many references, jokes, and allusions that she sometimes seemed vaguely foreign to us, and we to her. There was this subtle but unmistakable mental hitch. These days, it feels a little like that. Here's what I'm missing. I miss the way caffeine and its rituals used to order my day, especially in the morning. Herbal teas, which are barely, if at all, psychoactive, lack coffee and tea's power to organize the day into a rhythm of energetic peaks and valleys as the mental tide of caffeine ebbs and flows. The morning surge is a blessing, obviously, but there's also something comforting in the ebb tide of afternoon, which a cup of tea can gently reverse. I miss the enveloping aroma and the sounds of coffee, whether it's the mechanical scream of beans being ground or the more contented burbling of the coffee as it brews. Actually, those sensory gifts are still available to me every time I walk by a cafe, but it turns out the smells and sounds by themselves are merely a taunt if not followed by consummation. I've taken to brewing coffee for Judith at home, grinding the smoky woodsy aromas out of the beans and inhaling the steam off her cup before I hand it to her, hoping to imbibe some hint of mental stimulant before I head off to my desk to sip my chamomile tea. What work of genius has ever been composed on chamomile? What mental breakthrough has ever been credited to mint tea? It's a miracle I've gotten this far with the story. I miss being able to take part in coffee culture, idling in cafes and taking in the scene. Even as the mind accelerates, the body slows and is perfectly content to while away the time. Curiously, that culture no longer revolves around conversation, which has all but dried up in the modern coffee house. It's been replaced by the mental industry of coffee drinkers tapping away on their laptops with a sense of urgency I can't even pretend to. So many important projects. Sure, I can sit there among them with my tisane, but it's not the same. I no longer swim in the same caffeine sea as everyone else. Beached, I can still see the water, but it's way over there. There are some compensatory benefits. I'm sleeping like a teenager again and wake feeling actually refreshed. There's an explanation for that I will get to. I've discovered an odd and unexpected social benefit as well. When I turn down offers of coffee and explain my experiment in abstention, I find that people are keenly interested and, oddly, sort of impressed. It's as though I've notched some kind of achievement. I could never do that, a friend will say, or I should really try that. I know it would help me sleep, but I can't imagine getting through the morning. Naturally, these reactions make me feel as though I've actually done something worthy of admiration. I suspect I'm benefiting from the echoes of Puritanism still reverberating in our culture, which even now awards points for self-discipline and overcoming desire. Addiction, even to a relatively harmless and easily procured drug like caffeine, is seen as evidence of weakness of character. Quote, "I realized my life was being controlled by caffeine," a sleep researcher and caffeine abstainer that I interviewed told me. Quote, "Traveling, I'd find myself in an unfamiliar city and could not turn in for bed until I had scoped out where I was going to get my fix in the morning. I liked to feel in control and realized I wasn't. Caffeine was controlling me." Roland Griffiths, the drug researcher, told me that he had been inspired to study caffeine after embarrassing himself with his own, quote, "revolting behavior." In a hurry and in need of a caffeine fix, he had thrown some frozen coffee grinds into a cup, added hot water, swished it around, and downed it. Quote, "I recognize drug-seeking behavior when I see it." Yet he agreed that there's nothing inherently wrong with an addiction if you have a secure supply, no known health risk, and you're not offended by the idea. Yet many of us can't help moralizing addiction. I will confess to indulging in the occasional pang of righteousness. Ordinarily, a walk through the airport during my months of abstention filled me with yearning and envy as I rolled past one aromatic caffeine opportunity after another. But matters look very different to a reformed addict first thing in the morning. One such morning, having hauled myself out of bed and to the airport for a 6 a.m. flight, fueled on nothing but peppermint tea, I registered only pity as I beheld the lines snaking in front of the Starbucks and Pete's, lines so long it would take easily a half hour for these poor wretches to get served. I could see that they were enduring the first symptoms of caffeine withdrawal, and their desperation to head them off and return to baseline consciousness carried a whiff of pathos. They looked like better-dressed versions of the junkies I had seen in Amsterdam, lining up in front of a mobile dispensary for their morning fix. I thought to myself, these people are pathetic. Now, this is not a thought I'm proud of. In fact, I look forward to rejoining the ranks of the caffeine dependent as soon as I can. In the meantime, however, I try to savor the moral elevation and self-regard one feels living free of this addiction. For now, that's pretty much all I've got. At some point, I began to wonder if perhaps it was all in my head, this sense that I had lost a mental step since getting off coffee and tea. The debt to coffee, so freely acknowledged by the mental giants of the Age of Reason and the Enlightenment, fed my suspicion I might still be suffering from a subtle, or perhaps not so subtle, mental deficiency. Since I had not given up wine during the period of my caffeine abstention, was it possible I had personally reversed the forward march of intellectual progress in the West, casting myself back into the medieval mists of slow and magical thinking? Yet even without the mental clarity bestowed by caffeine, I knew better than to put much weight on the anecdotal or the N of one. So I decided to check in with capital S science to learn what, if any, cognitive enhancement can actually be attributed to caffeine. What was I really missing? I found numerous studies conducted over the years reporting that caffeine improves performance on a range of cognitive measures of memory, focus, alertness, vigilance, attention, and learning. An experiment done in the 1930s found that chess players on caffeine performed significantly better than players who abstained. In another study, caffeine users completed a variety of mental tasks more quickly, though they made more errors. As one paper put it in its title, people on caffeine are faster but not smarter. In a 2014 experiment, subjects given caffeine immediately after learning new material remembered it better than subjects who received a placebo. Tests of psychomotor abilities also suggest caffeine gives us an edge. In simulated driving exercises, caffeine improves performance, especially when the subject is tired. It also enhances physical performance on such metrics as time trials, muscle strength, and endurance. So a quick summary of the research would suggest I really have given up a mental and physical edge by giving up caffeine. True, there is reason to take these findings with a pinch of salt, if only because this kind of research is difficult to do well. The problem is finding a good control group in a society where virtually everyone is addicted to caffeine. If you compare the performance of two groups, one to whom you've given a caffeine tablet and the other a placebo, the chances are strong that the placebo group is in the throes of caffeine withdrawal and so at a distinct disadvantage performing any sort of cognitive or motor task. It could be that caffeine is merely restoring volunteers to normal baseline mental function rather than enhancing it. Researchers can overcome this problem by making sure their volunteers have been free of caffeine for a week or two, and many of them do. The consensus seems to be that caffeine does improve mental and physical performance to some degree. The science suggests that in all likelihood, I have lost a mental step since embarking on this experiment, relative to my previous coffee and tea drinking self. I hereby apologize for any lapses that may have occurred as a result. Whether caffeine also enhances creativity is a different question, however, and there's some reason to doubt that it does, Balzac's fervent belief to the contrary. Caffeine improves our focus and ability to concentrate, which surely enhances linear and abstract thinking, but creativity works very differently. It may depend on the loss of a certain kind of focus and the freedom to let the mind off the leash of linear thought. Cognitive psychologists sometimes talk in terms of two distinct types of consciousness: spotlight consciousness, which illuminates a single focal point of attention, making it very good for reasoning, and lantern consciousness, in which attention is less focused, yet illuminates a broader field of attention. Young children tend to exhibit lantern consciousness. So do many people on psychedelics. This more diffuse form of attention lends itself to mind wandering, free association, and the making of novel connections, all of which can nourish creativity. By comparison, caffeine's big contribution to human progress has been to intensify spotlight consciousness, the focused, linear, abstract, and efficient cognitive processing more closely associated with mental work than play. This, more than anything else, is what made caffeine the perfect drug not only for the age of reason and the Enlightenment, but for the rise of capitalism too. Speaking of focus, sorry, but I didn't mean to drop the thread of caffeine history we'd been following a while back. Let me try to pick it up. The soaring popularity of the coffee house in 17th century Europe posed a problem for business interests there, since at the time, Arab traders had an absolute monopoly on coffee beans. They profited from every cup of coffee consumed in London, Paris, or Amsterdam. It was a monopoly the Arabs zealously guarded. To prevent anyone from growing coffee anywhere but in the lands they controlled, Arab traders roasted coffee beans, which are seeds after all, before they were exported to ensure that they couldn't be germinated. But in 1616, a wily Dutchman managed to break the Arab stranglehold on Coffea Arabica. He smuggled live coffee plants out of Mocha, the Yemeni port city, and took them to the botanical garden in Amsterdam, where they were grown under glass, and additional plants were eventually propagated by cutting. You can create a new, genetically identical plant by rooting a shoot or branch in soil. One of those clones ended up in the Dutch-controlled Indonesian island of Java, where the Dutch East India Company successfully propagated it, eventually producing enough coffee plants to establish a plantation there, hence the prize coffee known as Mocha Java. In 1714, two descendants of the Dutchman's larcenous coffee bush were given to King Louis XIV, who had it planted in the king's garden in Paris. A few years later, a former French naval officer named Gabriel Duclos dreamed up a scheme to establish coffee production in the French colony of Martinique, where he lived. In a second momentous coffee theft, he claimed to have recruited a woman at court to purloin a cutting of the king's plant. After successfully rooting the cutting, Duclos installed the little plant in a glass box to protect it from the elements and brought it with him on a ship bound for Martinique. The crossing proved difficult, taking so much longer than anticipated that the supply of drinking water on board had to be strictly rationed. Determined to keep his coffee plant alive, Duclos shared his meager ration of water with it. Duclos claimed to have nearly died of thirst at sea, but his sacrifice ensured that the plant made it safely to Martinique, where it thrived. By 1730, France's Caribbean colonies were shipping coffee back to what by then was a Europe hopelessly addicted to caffeine. Much of the coffee grown in the New World today are clones of that original plant smuggled out of Mocha in 1616 offspring of a theft almost Promethean in its impact. Now the West had taken control of coffee, and coffee took control of the West. At the time coffee appeared in Europe in the 17th century, alcohol was by far the most popular psychoactive drug. Partly because of its antiseptic properties, partly, alcohol was being consumed morning, noon, and night. Not only in taverns after dark, but for breakfast at home and even in the workplace, where it was routinely given to laborers on their breaks. Before coffee and tea, the English mind was befogged most of the day by more or less constant infusions of alcohol. Campaigns for temperance sprang up from time to time, but without a substitute beverage, they failed to gain traction. Enter coffee. As early as 1660, writer and historian James Howell could note, quote, "'Tis found already that this coffee drink hath caused a greater sobriety among the nations. For whereas formerly apprentices and clerks, with others, used to take their morning draught in ale, beer, or wine, which by the dizziness they cause in the brain make many unfit for business, they use now to play the good fellows in this wakeful and civil drink." Howell deserves credit for having recognized so early the impact of coffee on the nature of work, for it would prove far-reaching years later when the English economy would begin its shift from a reliance on physical labor to mental labor. Long before the coffee break, there was the beer break, commonly offered to laborers doing physical work outdoors. Mental clarity was not a priority, nor was attention to clock time. For laborers working with machines, however, a mind dulled by alcohol was a hazard to both safety and productivity. And for clerks and others who worked with numbers, the alertness, focus, and all-around mental clarity coffee afforded made it the ideal drug, quote, "the beverage of the modern bourgeois age," in the words of Wolfgang Schivelbusch. Coffee showed up in Europe at exactly the right moment. Quote, "it spread through the body and achieved chemically and pharmacologically what rationalism and the Protestant ethic sought to fulfill spiritually and ideologically. The rationalist drug par excellence, coffee helped disperse Europe's alcoholic fog, fostering a heightened alertness and attention to detail, and, as employers soon discovered, dramatically improving productivity." Surely it is more than a coincidence that coffee and the minute hand on clocks arrived at more or less the same historical moment. For medieval man, and especially for the man doing physical labor outdoors, the angle of the sun mattered more than the hand of the clock. There had been no minute hand because there had been no need to subdivide the hour. But new kinds of work demanded much closer attention to time and its increments. And what psychoactive drug is more time-bound than caffeine, is more closely tied to the temporal landmarks of the day? Think of T.S. Eliot's Prufrock measuring out his life in coffee spoons. Work now was not only moving indoors, but also being reorganized on the principle of the clock, regularized and routinized, and this shift called for a new temporal discipline that coffee and tea could help to enforce. But the most important contribution that caffeine made to modern work, and in turn to the rise of capitalism, was to liberate us from the fixed rhythms of the sun, an astronomical timepiece that also sets the clocks of our bodies. The whole idea of a late shift, let alone a night shift, was inconceivable. The human body simply would not permit it. But the power of caffeine to keep us awake and alert, to stem the natural tide of exhaustion, freed us from the circadian rhythms of our biology, and so, along with the advent of artificial light, opened the frontier of night to the possibilities of work. This, quote, "wakefulness wrested from nature," as one early 19th century German physician described caffeine's gift to humankind, thus allowed us to adapt our bodies and our minds to the requirements of modern life and industry. What coffee did for clerks and intellectuals, tea would soon do for the English working class. Indeed, it was tea from the East Indies, heavily sweetened with sugar from the West Indies, that fueled the Industrial Revolution. We think of England as a tea culture, but coffee, initially the cheaper beverage by far, dominated at first. It wasn't until the British East India Company, which had limited access to coffee-producing regions, began trading regularly with China in the first part of the 18th century that tea could displace coffee as the principal medium for delivering caffeine to the English bloodstream. Cheap tea flooded the country, and a beverage that only the well-to-do could drink in 1700 was by 1800 consumed by virtually everyone. Tea sustained the English working class through long shifts, brutal working conditions, and more or less constant hunger. The caffeine in tea helped quiet the hunger pangs, and the sugar in it became a crucial source of calories. Caffeine helped create a new kind of worker, one better adapted to the rule of the machine, demanding, dangerous, and incessant. It's difficult to imagine an industrial revolution without it. I've avoided, at least up to now, attempting to answer the questions of value with which we began, when I wondered whether caffeine represented a boon or a bane to civilization and/or our species. The widespread use of caffeine is, arguably, one of those developments in human history, like the control of fire or the domestication of plants and animals, that helped lift us out of the state of nature, providing a new degree of control over biology. In this case, our own. But is this an absolutely good thing or bad thing? I put the question of whether caffeine was a boon or not to Roland Griffith during one of our Skype interviews. He had a tall Starbucks cup in front of him and paused for a long time before answering. Sure, given the way our culture works, that we have times we need to be awake and asleep and need to report to work at certain times, we're no longer able to just respond to our natural biological rhythms. So to the extent that caffeine helps us sync up our rhythms to the requirements of civilization, caffeine is useful. Whether that's helpful to our species is another question, he finished, trailing off, but clearly implying it was not. Much depends on where you stand on the trade-offs of modern life, and especially those of capitalism. Philosopher Michel Foucault's concept of body discipline could profitably be used to describe the effects of caffeine, since it helped bend humans to the wheel of the machine and the requirements of a new economic and mental order. Looked at that way, caffeine is a curse, addicting us to a regime that makes us more tractable and productive workers, speeding us up so that we might better keep pace with the man-made machinery of modern life. The ancient Greeks give us another way to look at something like coffee or tea. Each of these plants is a pharmakon, a word that can mean either a poison or a remedy, or it can be both at once, depending on how the substance is used. A pharmakon can also be a scapegoat, something on which people can blame things. Caffeine is a poison insofar as it undermines our usual bodily and mental rhythms, our nature. And at the same time, it can be a blessing, insofar as it frees us from those rhythms. Caffeine equips us to cope with the world caffeine helped us to create. The question of who benefited more from the advent of caffeine, factory or worker, capital or labor, was the subject of a lively debate that came to a head in mid-20th century America. In the 1920s, a time when management and efficiency emerged as a science, the impact of coffee on the workplace was studied closely. A consensus emerged that it led to a, quote, increased capacity for work, in the words of one researcher, and offered a, quote, aid to factory efficiency. But scientists were perplexed as to exactly how caffeine could augment people's energy. Energy in biological systems was understood as a function of calories, yet unsweetened coffee or tea contained no calories whatsoever. So where did this new increment of human energy come from? It seemed to violate the laws of thermodynamics, suggesting that caffeine might offer a kind of physiological free lunch. But regardless of whether this could be explained scientifically, employers were quick to recognize and seize on the potential benefits of caffeine to themselves. Actually, one of the first employers to seize on the practical value of caffeine was the Union Army during the Civil War. The Army issued each soldier 36 pounds of coffee a year. At the same time, the economic blockade of the South deprived the Confederacy of coffee. According to historian John Grinspan, the loss of coffee took a toll on the morale and perhaps also the performance of Confederate soldiers, while its easy availability to Union soldiers gave them an edge. One Union general went so far as to weaponize caffeine, ordering his soldiers to fill their canteens with coffee before battle and planning his attacks for the times when his troops were maximally caffeinated. But the troops symbolized a larger truth, that the Civil War represented the victory of the caffeinated North with its sped-up industrialized economy over the slower, uncaffeinated rural economy of the Confederacy. Ever since, the American military has made caffeine in all its forms, including tablets and especially formulated chewing gum, readily available to its soldiers. To better understand the origins of the coffee break, a term not in use until the 1950s, consider the case of two companies in Buffalo, New York: the Larkin Company, a soap manufacturer, and the Barkalow Manufacturing Company, maker of the Barkalounger. In the first years of the 20th century, Barkalow offered mid-morning and mid-afternoon breaks to employees. However, they had to bring in and brew their own coffee. Workers chipped in to buy the coffee, and the company's sole female employee brewed it. Larkin, by contrast, offered coffee free to its employees, but didn't give them any break time in which to drink it. It wasn't until the 1950s that the modern concept of the coffee break, free coffee plus paid time in which to enjoy it, was fully established as a legally recognized institution in the American workplace. This happened at a neckwear company in Denver called Los Wigwam Weavers. The story is told in Coffeeland by historian Augustine Sedgwick. When wigwam owner Phil Grenitz lost his best young employees to the war effort, he hired older men to operate the looms. Because of the intricacy of the designs and number of colors in the neckties, the work was exacting and exhausting, and the older men failed to meet the company's quality standards. Grenitz then tried hiring middle-aged women to operate the looms. The women had the necessary dexterity, but lacked the endurance to work a full shift. At a company-wide meeting to discuss the problem, employees proposed they be given 2 15-minute breaks, one in the morning, one in the afternoon, and that they be provided with coffee. Grenitz took their suggestions, establishing a break room and supplying it with coffee and tea. Very soon, quote, he noticed a change in his workers, Sedgwick writes. 4 women who had been among the worst workers were now among the best. Altogether, the middle-aged women began to do as much work in 6.5 hours as the older men had done in 8 hours. Encouraged, Grenitz made the breaks compulsory. Yet Grenitz felt he shouldn't have to pay the workers for what he regarded as time off, so he docked them for the 30 minutes of break time. Deducting this time from the employees' paychecks caused their wages to fall below the federal minimum, however, prompting a suit against the company from the U.S. Department of Labor. Quote, in court, Sedgwick writes, Grenitz testified to the extraordinary changes he had observed in his employees since instituting the coffee breaks, but because the breaks weren't work time, he argued, he wasn't obliged to pay his workers for it. The company ultimately lost in federal court. The court ruled that, though the breaks certainly benefited the workers, they were at least, quote, equally beneficial to the employer in that they promote more efficiency and result in a greater output. And this increased production is one of the primary factors, if not the prime factor, which leads the employer to institute such break periods, end quote. The judge also pointed out, rightly, that coffee breaks bore, quote, a close relationship to work and therefore must be compensated as such. The decision enshrined the paid coffee break in American life. As Sedgwick points out, quote, the principle that physiologists and bosses had already discovered in practice, that coffee adds something to the working power of the human body, independent of the processes and timescales of eating and digestion, something beyond what the science of energy and the laws of thermodynamics say is possible, became itself a kind of law. As for the term coffee break, it appears to have been popularized in 1952 in an advertising campaign by the Pan American Coffee Bureau, the marketing arm of coffee growers in South and Central America. Their slogan, give yourself a coffee break and get what coffee gives to you. So how exactly does coffee, and caffeine more generally, give us what it gives us? How could this little molecule possibly supply the human body energy without calories? Could caffeine be the proverbial free lunch? Or do we pay a price for the mental and physical energy, the alertness, focus, and stamina that caffeine gives us? To answer these questions, it's necessary to understand something about the pharmacology of caffeine. Caffeine is a tiny molecule that happens to fit snugly into an important receptor in the central nervous system, allowing it to occupy it and therefore block the neuromodulator that would normally bind to that receptor and activate it. That neuromodulator is called adenosine. Caffeine, its antagonist, keeps adenosine from doing its job by getting in its way. Adenosine is a psychoactive compound that has a depressive and hypnotic, that is sleep-inducing effect, on the brain when it binds to its receptor. It diminishes the rate at which our neurons fire. Over the course of the day, adenosine levels gradually rise in the bloodstream, and as long as no other molecule is blocking its action, it begins to slow mental operations in preparation for sleep. As adenosine builds up in your brain, you begin to feel less alert and a mounting desire to go to bed, what scientists call sleep pressure. But when caffeine beats adenosine to those receptor sites, the brain no longer receives a signal to begin turning out the mental lights. Even so, the adenosine is still circulating in your brain. In fact, its levels continue to rise, but because the receptors have been hijacked, you don't feel its effects. Instead, you feel wide awake and alert. Are you really? Yes and no. How you feel is how you feel, it's true. But as Matthew Walker, a UC Berkeley sleep researcher, explains, since adenosine continues to build up, you've only been tricked by caffeine, which is hiding its existence from you, and only temporarily. What I've described here is the direct effect of caffeine on the brain. The chemical also has several indirect effects, including increases in adrenaline, serotonin, and dopamine. The release of dopamine is typical of drugs of abuse and probably accounts for caffeine's mood-enhancing qualities, the cup of optimism, as well as the fact that it is habit-forming. Caffeine is also a vasodilator and can be mildly diuretic. It temporarily raises blood pressure and relaxes the body's smooth muscles, which may account for coffee's laxative effect. This could explain much of coffee's early popularity. Constipation was a serious matter in 17th and 18th century Europe. But what is unique about caffeine is the targeted way in which it interferes with one of the most important of all biological functions, sleep. Walker, in his recent book, Why We Sleep, argues that the consumption of caffeine, the most widely used psychoactive stimulant in the world, quote, represents one of the longest and largest unsupervised drug studies ever conducted on the human race. We now know the results of that study. And if Walker is to be believed, they are downright alarming. For as long as humans have been drinking coffee and tea, medical authorities, as well as quacks of various persuasions, have warned about the perils to human health posed by these beverages, which is to say, the dangers of caffeine. And ever since the 17th century, when women worried about coffee's effect on male potency, the presumption has been that there must be a problem. Perhaps because we believe more deeply in the iron law of compensation than in the possibility of a free lunch, researchers have undertaken a massive, worldwide, centuries-long search to pinpoint caffeine's karmic payback, the way in which our fond habit must surely be killing us. Cancer? Hypertension? Heart disease? Mental illness? At one time or another, caffeine has been implicated in all these problems and a great many more. And yet, at least till now, caffeine has been cleared of the most serious charges against it. The current scientific consensus is more than reassuring. In fact, the research suggests that coffee and tea, far from being deleterious to our health, may offer some important benefits, as long as they aren't consumed to excess. Regular coffee consumption is associated with a decreased risk of several cancers, including breast, prostate, colorectal, and endometrial. Cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes, Parkinson's disease, and possibly depression and suicide. Though high doses can produce nervousness and anxiety, and suicide rates may climb among people who drink 8 or more cups a day. Coffee and tea are also the leading source of antioxidants in our diet, though you can get these antioxidants by drinking decaf too. My review of the medical literature on coffee and tea made me wonder if my abstention might be compromising not only my mental function, but my physical health as well. However, that was before I read and then met and interviewed Matt Walker. Why We Sleep is one of the scarier books I've read. Walker, an English neuroscientist on the faculty at UC Berkeley, is a compact and wired man. I would describe him as caffeinated, except that I know he is not. He is single-minded in his mission, to alert the world to an invisible public health crisis, which is that we are not getting nearly enough sleep, the sleep we are getting stinks, and a principal culprit in this crime against the body and mind is caffeine. Caffeine itself might not be bad for you, but the sleep it's stealing from you could be deadly. According to Walker, research shows that insufficient sleep may be a key factor in the development of Alzheimer's disease, arteriosclerosis, stroke, heart failure, depression, anxiety, suicide, and obesity. The shorter you sleep, he bluntly concludes, the shorter your lifespan. Matt Walker grew up in England drinking copious amounts of black tea morning, noon, and night. He no longer consumes caffeine, save for the small amounts in his occasional cup of decaf. In fact, none of the sleep researchers or experts on circadian rhythms that I interviewed for this story use caffeine themselves. I thought of myself as a pretty good sleeper before I met Matt Walker. At lunch, he probed me about my sleep habits. I told him I usually get a solid 7 hours, fall asleep easily, dream most nights. "How many times a night do you wake up?" he asked. "I'm up 3 or 4 times a night, usually to pee, but I almost always fall right back to sleep." He nodded gravely. "That's really not good, all those interruptions. Sleep quality is just as important as sleep quantity. The interruptions were undermining the amount of deep or slow-wave sleep I was getting, something above and beyond the REM sleep I had always thought was the measure of a good night's shut-eye. But it seems that deep sleep is just as important to our health, and the amount we get tends to decline with age. During deep sleep, low-frequency brain waves set out from the frontal cortex and travel toward the back of the brain, in the process synchronizing many thousands of brain cells into a kind of neural symphony. This harmonizing of our neurons helps us to distill and consolidate the blizzard of information we've taken in during the day. Memories are carried on these slow waves from sites of short-term daily storage to more permanent locations. Picture the mental desktop being cleared off and reorganized at the end of the workday as the brain's files are stowed in their proper place or trashed. With all the interruptions I was experiencing, Walker guessed I was sorely deficient in deep sleep. You probably want to address that. That night, he sent me a link for a supplement that purported to improve prostate function. At the time of our lunch, I hadn't yet begun my abstinence experiment, and Walker inquired about my caffeine use. A cup of half-caf first thing, green tea through the morning, and sometimes, if I'm flagging, a cappuccino after lunch. Walker explained that for most people, the quarter life of caffeine is usually about 12 hours, meaning that 25% of the caffeine in a cup of coffee consumed at noon is still circulating in your brain when you go to bed at midnight. That could well be enough to completely wreck your deep sleep. I shuddered to think about the occasional cup of coffee after dinner. Some people say that they can drink coffee at night and fall right to sleep, Walker said, a note of pity in his voice. That might be the case, but the amount of slow-wave sleep will drop by 15 to 20%, he said. For me to decrease your deep sleep by that much, I'd have to age you by 20%. Which meant that after-dinner espresso would give me the lousy night's sleep of a man 12 years my senior. I pictured the anarchy of my computer's desktop after a long day of work when I have neglected to perform any digital hygiene. Caffeine is not the sole cause of our sleep crisis. Screens, alcohol, which is as hard on REM sleep as caffeine is on deep sleep, pharmaceuticals, work schedules, noise and light pollution, and anxiety can all play a role in undermining both the duration and quality of our sleep. But caffeine is at or near the top of the list of culprits. Walker says, quote, "If you plot the rise in the number of Starbucks coffee houses over the past 35 years and the rise in sleep deprivations over that period, the lines look very similar." Here's what's uniquely insidious about caffeine. The drug is not only a leading cause of our sleep deprivation, it is also the principal tool we rely on to remedy the problem. Most of the caffeine consumed today is being used to compensate for the lousy sleep for which caffeine bears responsibility, which means that caffeine is helping to hide from our awareness the very problem that caffeine creates. Charles Seisler, an expert on sleep and circadian rhythms at Harvard Medical School, put the matter starkly several years ago in a National Geographic article by T.R. Reid. The principal reason that caffeine is used around the world is to promote wakefulness. But the principal reason that people need that crutch is inadequate sleep. Think about that. We use caffeine to make up for a sleep deficit that is largely the result of using caffeine. When I recently spoke to Seisler, he told me he doesn't use caffeine either, but shared a story about his thesis advisor at Stanford who did. Bill Dement is a legendary sleep researcher involved in the discovery of the connection between REM sleep and dreams and the creator of the field of sleep disorder medicine. Quote, "Once when he stayed with us, he came downstairs in the morning and asked, 'Where's the coffee?' We didn't even own a coffee maker. I'm sorry, Bill, but as you well know, caffeine is the enemy of sleep." "True," he replied, "but it's also the friend of waking." I'm not sure Matt Walker would find that story the least bit funny. The sleep issue suggests an answer to the conundrum of how caffeine could be a source of human energy. It only looks that way because caffeine is simply hiding or postponing our exhaustion by blocking the action of adenosine. As the liver removes the caffeine from circulation, the dam holding back all that pent-up, still-mounting adenosine will break. And when the rebounding chemical floods the brain, you will crash, feeling even more tired than you did before that first cup of coffee. So what will you do then? Probably have another cup. It appears that there is no free lunch. The energy that cup of coffee or tea has given you has been borrowed from the future and must eventually be paid back. What's more, there is interest to be paid on that loan, and it can be calculated in the quantity and quality of your sleep. Our story about the cup of concentrated sunshine does seem to be darkening, and I'm afraid it will darken further before it is over. A case can be made that coffee and tea did make a substantial positive contribution to the advance of, quote-unquote, civilization in the West, if by that we mean the various blessings of culture and capitalism, including the arts and sciences and the standard of living. But just as consumers of caffeine eventually must pay a biological price for the energy supplied by their drug of choice, an economic and even moral price has been paid as well. Almost from the start, the blessings of coffee and tea in the West were inextricably bound up with the sins of slavery and imperialism. In a global system of production organized with such brutal rationality, it could only have been fueled by, what else? Caffeine itself. Coffee and tea, as commodities produced in the global South to be consumed in the North, entangled all who drank them in an intricate new web of international economic relations. The spice trade, another vibrant market in plant stimulants, preceded the caffeine trade by a few centuries, but it mainly involved the affluent. By the end of the 18th century, tea was being consumed daily by just about everyone in England, and it became the most important commodity traded by the British East India Company. It appears a very strange thing, David Davies, an English cleric, observed in the late 1700s, that the common people of any European nation should be obliged to use, as part of their daily diet, two articles imported from opposite sides of the earth. The two articles Davies had in mind were tea and sugar, which became paired in England soon after tea's introduction, somewhat surprisingly, since tea in China was never sweetened. No one knows exactly why the practice took root, but the tea imported by Great Britain tended to be bitter and, as a hot beverage, could readily absorb large amounts of sugar. In fact, one of the principal uses of sugar in Britain was as a sweetener of tea, and the custom drove a substantial increase in sugar consumption, which in turn drove an expansion of slavery to run the sugar plantations of the Caribbean. Coffee was even more directly implicated in the slave trade, especially in Brazil, where coffee growers imported large numbers of slaves from Africa to work on their plantations. How many tea and coffee drinkers in Europe had any idea that their sober and civilized habit rested on the back of such brutality? The British East India Company's tea trade with China bore a moral stain of another kind. Since the company had to pay for tea in sterling, and China had little interest in English goods, England began running a ruinous trade deficit with China. The East India Company came up with two clever strategies to improve its balance of payments position. It turned to India, a country with no history of large-scale tea production, and transformed it into a leading producer of both tea and opium. The tea was exported to England, and the opium, over the strenuous objections of the Chinese government, was smuggled into China in what would quickly become a ruinous and unconscionable flood. By 1828, the opium trade represented 16% of the company's revenues, and within 5 years, it was sending more than 5 million pounds of Indian opium to China per year. This certainly helped close the trade deficit, but millions of Chinese became addicted, contributing to the decline of what had been a great civilization. After the Chinese emperor ordered the seizure of all stores of opium in 1839, Britain declared war to keep the opium flowing. Owing to their navy's vastly superior firepower, Britain soon prevailed, forcing open 5 treaty ports and taking possession of Hong Kong in a crushing blow to China's sovereignty and economy. So here was another cost of caffeine. In order for the English mind to be sharpened with tea, the Chinese mind had to be clouded with opium. Those of us who enjoy a cup of coffee or tea today know scarcely more about the system that produces it than consumers did during the time of slavery or the opium wars. The intricate supply chain that delivers us our daily dose of caffeine is largely invisible, and while it no longer rests on the backs of African slaves or Chinese opium addicts, a regime of economic exploitation remains at its base. For every $4 latte, only a few pennies ever reach the farmers who grew the beans, most of whom are smallholders working a few steeply raked acres in some rural corner of a tropical country. In recent years, the global price for coffee beans has moved in giant destructive swings as the market does what markets do, scours the world for the lowest price producer at any given moment. In the 1960s, the world's coffee-growing nations banded together to limit those swings by managing supply cooperatively. The International Coffee Agreement set export quotas for each coffee-producing nation as a way to keep prices stable within a certain range. This worked for many years. But in 1989, after the rise of neoliberal economics and the consolidation of buying power in the hands of a small number of multinational corporations, the coffee agreement fell apart. Prices now are set by futures markets in London and New York and move up and down dramatically and unpredictably. In many years, farmers are forced to sell their beans for less than it costs to grow them. Of the $10 you might pay for a pound of coffee, only about $1 reaches the farmer who grew it. At the higher end of the market, a handful of companies like Starbucks and certification schemes like Fairtrade International are seeking to improve the lot of coffee farmers by paying them a guaranteed price. But a free market in any commodity crop that is grown by millions of small producers and bought by only a tiny handful of large buyers will inevitably enrich the latter while tending to impoverish the former. Perhaps you think I'm painting such a dark picture of coffee and tea because, like those Confederate troops, I've been demoralized by the fact I can't have any. You also may be wondering why I seem to be reducing the rich, complex culture surrounding these two beverages to brain chemistry and economics. Surely this is an overly reductive way to look at things as wonderful as coffee and tea. You have a point. I don't mean to take anything away from the intricate cultures that surround tea and coffee and transcend the chemical they share. The epitome of caffeine culture is, of course, the Japanese tea ceremony, which elevates the preparation and consumption of tea to a spiritual practice. With the ceremony's multiple layers of ritual, Zen philosophy, elaborate manners, scripted dialogue, and cherished paraphernalia, one could easily lose sight of the fact that one is consuming a drug. Why is there no comparable coffee ceremony? There have been attempts, surely you have met such coffee fetishists, but their efforts pale in comparison. What I find curious is just how different in character and symbolism these two caffeine delivery systems have become. How did the culture of tea become so much more refined than the brawny culture of coffee? Perhaps it has something to do with the fact that a cup of coffee delivers a stronger jolt than tea, which contains less than half as much caffeine. But drink a second cup of tea and you'll be equally caffeinated, so that can't be the whole story. Perhaps it is the taste or chemistry or the region of origin that explains it, or perhaps the different cultural associations of coffee and tea are simply accidents of history. Whatever the reason, the differences are striking. In The World of Caffeine, Bennett Allen Weinberg and Bonnie K. Beeler neatly contrast the rival cultures by proposing a series of sharp dualities. These are so obvious that I don't need to tell you which term applies to which beverage. Male, female. Boisterous, decorous. Bohemian, conventional. Obvious, subtle. Indulgence, temperance. Vice, virtue. Passion, spirituality. Casual, ceremonial. Down to earth, elevated. American, English. The frontier, the drawing room. Excitement, tranquility. Demi-monde, society. Extroverted, introverted. Full-blooded, effete. Occidental, oriental. Work, contemplation. Tension, relaxation. Spontaneity, deliberation. Beethoven, Mozart. Balzac, Proust. And so on. The various delivery systems for alcohol exhibit a similar degree of elaboration. Just think of the cultural signifiers that go with wine versus those belonging to beer or hard liquor. We humans apparently have a deep desire to complicate things, to embroider the most basic biological response with the rich colors and textures of culture. In fact, the very idea these drinks each constitute a delivery system for a psychoactive compound offends us a bit. But someone who hears the elaborate descriptors for wine without ever having drunk it would have no idea that a key point about this beverage is that it changes consciousness. The same is true for coffee and tea, and certainly not true for most of the other liquids we consume. Does anyone think this deeply, this metaphorically, about the psychosensory qualities of orange juice or milk? No. Tea and coffee are special in this regard. Consider this list of descriptors used for cupping or tasting coffee that I stumbled on online. It comes from a nonprofit outfit called the World Coffee Research. The vegetal, earthy, herb category alone is subdivided into 20 flavor profiles, including leafy greens, hay straw, tobacco, cedar, fresh wood, and soil. Then there's savory, which includes meat-like and leathery. There is grain and cereal, subdivided into fresh bread, barley, wheat, rye, graham cracker, granola, and pastry. Sweet and sugary includes brown sugar, maple syrup, molasses, and cola. The other categories, nut, chocolate, dried fruit, berry, stone fruit, citrus, floral, spice, and roast, are also broken down into specific flavors. This list does not even include another set of descriptors pertaining to body or mouthfeel, such as tea-like, silky, round, velvety, big, and chewy, or a separate list for undesirable qualities, including mold, fruit decomposition, stale bread, Band-Aid, cardboard, compost, animal hide, and funk garbage. How wonderful to be able to discern and name such a panoply of flavors, aromas, and textures, almost all of nature, in a cup of coffee. Much the same thing could be said for tea, and surely has been. Some of these qualities are purely imaginary, no doubt, but most correspond to one of the hundreds of different molecules found in coffee. The esters, terpenes, amines, acids, ketones, and thiols that together make up our experience of it. All those flavors and aroma molecules are present in your cup, But how much would that matter if not for that one other molecule, 1,3,7-trimethylxanthine? Would people have ever discovered coffee or tea, let alone continued to drink them for hundreds of years, if not for caffeine? There are countless other seeds and leaves that can be steeped in hot water to make a beverage, and some number of them surely taste better than coffee or tea. But where are the shrines to those plants in our homes and offices and shops? Let's face it, the rococo structures of meaning we've erected atop those psychoactive molecules are just culture's way of dressing up our desire to change consciousness in the finery of metaphor and association. Indeed, what really commends these beverages to us is their association not with wood smoke or stone fruit, but with the experience of well-being, of euphoria, they reliably give us. It is this experience, known as reinforcement, that practically guarantees we will return to tea or coffee or wine. It also has the power to alter our perception of their flavors. People are badly deceived when it comes to taste, Roland Griffiths, the Johns Hopkins drug researcher, explained. It's like saying, "I like the taste of scotch." No, this is an acquired, conditioned taste preference. When you pair a taste with a reinforcer like alcohol or caffeine, you will confer a specific preference for that taste. Caffeine is naturally present in coffee and tea, but typically is added to sodas. So why would soda makers do that? Especially in a beverage marketed to children. The industry has claimed, to the FDA and other regulators, that the caffeine is there as a flavoring, and that they add it for the note of bitterness the alkaloid provides. They actually say this with a straight face. In the year 2000, Griffith's lab easily undermined the claim with a double-blind taste test in which cola drinkers were asked to detect differences in colas, some caffeinated and some uncaffeinated. Most couldn't taste the difference. And yet, the 6 top-selling soda brands in the U.S. all contain caffeine, typically about as much as in a cup of tea. Griffith says that if you pair caffeine with any flavor, people will express a preference for that flavor. Quote, "Just like when I say, I love the way scotch tastes." Griffith's experiment reminded me of another taste test I'd heard about, but it took me a moment to pinpoint what it was, no doubt because I was still off caffeine. Geraldine Wright's bees. Wright had done much the same test on her honeybees and discovered that they too developed a preference for nectar that had been caffeinated. "We humans are more like the bees than I realized, just as easily duped, in this case by the soda companies rather than plants, into preferring whichever brand of sugar water has had caffeine added to it. The soda makers have figured out what the plants learned to do a long time ago." The time had come to wrap up my experiment in caffeine deprivation. I had learned what I could from it and harvested a great number of excellent nights' sleep and was eager to see what a body that had been innocent of caffeine for 3 months would experience when subjected to a couple of shots of espresso. I had effectively returned myself to the condition of caffeine virgin and was more than ready to sacrifice that status in order to rejoin the human community of the caffeinated. I had thought long and hard, even lovingly, about where I'd go to enjoy my first cup. It was definitely going to be coffee. I didn't think tea could give me the psychoactive jolt I was looking forward to. At first, I considered getting my first cup from the Pete's in my neighborhood, which happens to be the original Pete's, founded in 1966. On the corner of Vine and Walnut in North Berkeley, Pete's is now something of a landmark, the site of a watershed moment in coffee history. It was Alfred Piet, the emigre son of a Dutch coffee roaster, who almost single-handedly introduced America to good coffee. Before Piet opened his shop, Americans drank instant or diner coffee from blue and white cardboard cups or percolated coffee made from cans of Folgers or Maxwell House grounds. At the time, most of this coffee was made from inferior Robusta beans, which are high in caffeine but bitter and one-dimensional in taste. But it was cheap, and it was all we knew. Piet, who had tasted better in the Netherlands, insisted on sourcing Arabica beans exclusively and roasting them slowly until they were quite dark. His exacting standards and old-world aesthetic created the coffee culture in which we now live. A generous man, Pete mentored a whole generation of American coffee importers and roasters, including the founders of Starbucks, who worked for him at the Berkeley shop, learning how to select beans and roast them. Pete also taught Americans to pay a few dollars, rather than a quarter or two, for a cup of coffee, transforming it into a new kind of everyday luxury good. So there would be a certain poetic logic to having my first cup at this local shrine to good coffee. Alas, I don't love Pete's coffee. Too often it tastes burnt. So in the end, I decided to honor a more personal coffee tradition. I would opt for a special at the Cheese Board, the shop down on Shattuck Avenue where Judith and I have been morning regulars for many years. A special is the Cheese Board's term for a double shot espresso drink made with somewhat less steamed milk than the typical cappuccino. I believe it's what the Australians would call a flat white. Out in front of the Cheese Board, a couple of parking spaces have been converted into a sweet little pocket park with a few benches, a couple of flower planters and trees, and a thick wooden counter to lean on. I seldom take the time to hang out there, but this was such a lovely midsummer Saturday morning that we decided to linger, finding a seat where we could enjoy our coffees and take in the scene. It was still early, so there were lots of paper cup-toting young parents with little kids deeply absorbed in their muffins and chocolate chip scones. The kids were having their own drug experience. My special was unbelievably good, a ringing reminder of what a poor counterfeit decaf is. Here were whole dimensions and depths of flavor I had completely forgotten about. I could almost feel the tiny molecules of caffeine spreading through my body, fanning out along the arterial pathways, sliding effortlessly through the walls of my cells, slipping across the blood-brain barrier to take up stations in my adenosine receptors. Well-being was the term that best described the first feeling I registered, and this built and spread and coalesced until I decided euphoria was warranted. And yet, there was none of the perceptual distortion that I associate with most other psychoactive drugs. My consciousness felt perfectly transparent, as if I were intoxicated on sobriety. But this was not the familiar caffeine feeling, the happy and grateful return to baseline as the first cup disperses the gathering fogs of withdrawal. No, this was something well up from baseline, almost as if my cup had been spiked with something stronger, something like cocaine. Wow, this stuff is legal? I looked around me, taking in the mellow sidewalk scene, the kids in their strollers and the dogs trailing them for crumbs. Everything in my visual field seemed pleasantly italicized, filmic. And I wondered if all those people with their cardboard sleeve swaddled cups had any idea what a powerful drug they were sipping. But how could they? They had long ago become habituated to caffeine and were now using it for another purpose entirely. Baseline maintenance, that is, plus a welcome lift. I felt lucky that this more powerful experience was available to me. This, along with the stellar sleeps, was the wonderful dividend of my investment in abstention. And yet, in a few days' time, I would be them, caffeine tolerant and addicted all over again. I wondered, was there any way to preserve the power of this drug? Could I devise a new relationship to caffeine? Maybe treat it more like a psychedelic, say, something to be taken only occasionally and with a greater degree of ceremony and intention. Maybe just drink coffee on Saturdays? I resolved to try. After about half an hour, I could feel the initial surge of optimism morph into something a bit more manic and tetchy. A garbage truck had pulled up to the curb outside a restaurant across the street. Unignorable, it began violently shaking tall plastic bins into its maw and then noisily devouring the garbage. The racket was unbearable, or so it felt, in what was becoming, I realized, my hypervigilant state. I began to feel antsy and started composing lists in my head of things I needed to get done today. I asked Judith if she was ready to go, and she agreed. The scene had lost its charm, so we walked back up the hill and home. Judith left to go to her studio, and I was left to do, well, whatever I wanted to do, while away the Saturday morning, putter in the garden, maybe make a few calls. But the caffeine had another idea. It wanted me to tackle my to-do list, harness the surge of energy, of focus coursing through me, and put it to some good use. For some reason, this had everything to do with throwing stuff out. I went to my computer and systematically unsubscribed from at least 100 listservs that had been clogging my inbox. This felt great. Until I felt too antsy to sit at my desk a moment longer. Another task suddenly demanded my attention. It was time to tackle my closet. This is not something I have ever done of my own free will. But at that moment, I wanted nothing more than to take all my sweaters off the shelf and sort them into four piles. In need of laundering, moth-eaten discards, giveaways, still in rotation. Ordinarily, I feel faithful to my old clothes and have a hard time acknowledging that any item has outlived its usefulness. But not today. Today, I was merciless and quickly filled a large garbage bag, not only with sweaters, but also sneakers, shirts, even sport jackets, all destined for goodwill and good riddance. The morning went on like that as I compulsively got stuff done on the computer, in my closet, in the garden, in the shed. I raked, I weeded, I put things in order as if I were possessed, as I guess I was. Whatever I focused on zealously and single-mindedly. I was like a horse wearing blinders. The periphery and its distractions had completely vanished from my field of awareness. I could sink myself into a task and fail to notice that an hour had passed. Around noon, my compulsiveness began to subside, and I felt ready for a change of scene. I had yanked a few plants out of the vegetable garden that were not pulling their weight and decided to go to the garden center to buy some replacements. It was during the drive down Solano Avenue that I began idly fantasizing about how I might get a second cup, and all at once I realized the true reason I was heading to this particular garden center. They had this Airstream trailer parked out front that served really good espresso drinks. I had only had a single cup of coffee after 3 months of abstinence, and already the insidious tentacles of dependence were beckoning. What had happened to my hours-old resolution to drink coffee only on Saturday? Then I heard a voice say, "But it is still Saturday." I knew immediately who it was. The clever and sinuous persona of the addict. It took all the willpower I could muster to resist it. Partway through my research for this story, it occurred to me that I had never actually laid eyes on a coffee or tea plant. Well, that's not entirely true. A few years ago, the Peets in my neighborhood kept a rather sad and scraggly coffee plant in a pot by the door, but it never bore fruit and didn't survive long. I had certainly never encountered a coffee plant in its native habitat. So I decided to pay Coffea Arabica a visit. Some other business had brought us to Medellin, the gateway to Colombia's premier coffee-growing region. So on a January morning, we hired a car to take us into the mountains south of the city. Our destination was Café de la Cima, a coffee farm or finca a few miles by rutted dirt road outside of Fredonia, a lively little market town stretched out in the shadow of Cerro Bravo. Along the way, we passed Cerro Tusa, the perfect green triangle of a volcano depicted on the logo for Colombian coffee. You've seen it 1,000 times on packages of beans and in all those commercials for Colombian coffee, the classic ones featuring Juan Valdez. It turns out Juan Valdez is a purely fictional campesino. He was born in the brain of an advertising copywriter in the Manhattan office of Doyle Day & Burnback, the ad agency, in 1958 for the purpose of selling Colombian coffee to the world. Octavio Acevedo and his son Humberto, the proprietors of Café de la Cima, could have served as role models for Valdez right down to the straw hat and colorful serape. The only thing missing from the scene is Conchita, Valdez's faithful burro. Humberto, who showed us around the 7-acre finca, is the fourth generation to grow coffee on this steep, lush hillside. But the operation has changed in important ways since his grandfather farmed it. 5 years ago, Humberto explained as we set out to visit his shrubs, my father decided he wanted to taste the coffee he was growing. This was a radical idea. Most campesinos sell their beans to middlemen while they're still green, freshly picked and unprocessed. If they drink coffee at all, it's coffee grown by someone else, and probably tinto, the thick, concentrated coffee made from cheap beans that most Colombians still drink. All the best beans go to the export market. But Octavio could see there was no future for a small farmer selling a commodity crop into what has become a turbulent global market. So he decided he would try to sell something different. Coffee that had been grown, harvested, cleaned, fermented, dried, and roasted on the farm. Café de la Cima would become a brand in an artisanal coffee market, as well as a destination for people like me curious to see where and how their coffee is produced. Umberto was eager to introduce us to the 12,000 coffee plants, a mix of Bourbon and Castillo, with whom the family shares this verdant, sun-drenched hillside. Coffee likes tropical mountains because the plant needs both plenty of rain and exceptionally good drainage in order to thrive. Growing at higher elevations, Café de la Cima is perched at 1,600 meters above sea level, also allows coffee to escape one of its most destructive pests, coffee leaf rust. Climate change is already pushing coffee production higher up the mountains and making life difficult for farmers. Coffee plants are notoriously picky about rainfall, temperature, and sunlight, all of which are changing in Colombia and rendering lands that had always been good for coffee production no longer viable. Worldwide, the prospects for coffee production in a changing climate are, according to the agronomists, dismal. By one estimate, roughly half of the world's coffee-growing acreage will be unproductive by 2050. Umberto led us up a steep path behind the house. We passed a nursery where he was sprouting coffee plants, dozens of tiny seedlings, each wearing a tan coffee bean like a cleft hat. It's easy to forget that coffee beans are first and foremost seeds. Rather than buy replacement plants when their production declines, Umberto has begun selecting and germinating his own, scouring the farm for specimens that thrive in his particular soil and microclimate. Up past the nursery, we crossed a little stream and stepped into the first row of coffee plants. Curving parallel lines of 5-foot-tall prune shrubs, thick with glossy green leaves and bearing slender branches lined with cherries. Most of the fruits were still green, but there were a handful of bright red ones that looked more like cranberries than cherries. Umberto handed Judith and me each a basket, worn in front at waist height and suspended by a strap over the shoulder. He shooed us away. Go, pick some coffee. We each went our own way, stepping gingerly down a different narrow row of spiky green shrubs. The hillside is so steep, I had to carefully sidestep my way from plant to plant, bending over and reaching through the leaves to pick only the reddish cherries, one by one, and dropping them in my basket. I bit into a ripe red one. The flesh tasted fruity and sweet, with just a suggestion of coffee flavor. And in the center sat a small, tan seed, divided into two lobes like a miniature pair of buttocks. Umberto had told me it takes 50 or so coffee beans to make a single cup of coffee. After a half hour of picking, I had collected enough beans for maybe 4 or 5 cups, and already my back and feet were in an uproar of pain. It was hard to believe coffee was still picked by hand, bean by bean, that so little has changed over the centuries. But the steepness of the orchards discourages both mechanization and consolidation. This is still an agriculture dominated by millions of small farmers with readier access to hands than to capital. The biggest innovation at Café de la Cima is the one that has put Conchita out of work. When a picker's basket is topped up, he no longer straps it to the back of a burro for the ride down the hillside. Now, he spills the basket of coffee cherries into a concrete box at the top of the hill. A stream of well water then flushes the cherries through a steel pipe, carrying them down the mountain and directly into the processing shed. I didn't pick enough coffee to fill my basket, not even close. I was stymied by having to stretch my legs and straighten up every few minutes, or my back would bitterly complain. The hillside was so precipitous and the rows so tightly planted that I found it difficult to secure a confident purchase with my feet. I felt off balance the entire time, which made it hard to work efficiently. Among the coffee shrubs, I felt like an interloper, a stranger in a habitat far more congenial to them than to a biped. As I stepped out of the row I'd been working and gazed out over the Andes, one verdant fold overlapping another, I could see rows of shiny green coffee plants snaking across the landscape, each following the horizontal contours and stepping up the sheer flanks of the mountains. It was hard to imagine how this remote and sleepy rural scene had anything whatsoever to do with our everyday urban lives, but one doesn't exist without the other. The two realms have become intimately connected and are now implicated in each other's destinies by powerful vectors of trade and desire. Our taste for coffee, only a few hundred years old, has reconfigured not only this landscape and the lives of the people who tend it, but the very rhythms of our civilization. Yet it wasn't coffee's taste alone that worked those wonders. It was also, crucially, the tiny molecule that contributed the bitterness to that drink, and what that molecule did to our minds once it found its way into our brains. What is impossible to see from this distance is how all the glossy green leaves blanketing these mountains are at this very moment transforming the strong rays of the tropical sun and the nutrients in these ruddy soils into 1,3,7-trimethylxanthine. The plants have turned these mountainsides into factories for the production of caffeine. What is difficult to square standing here is how a landscape as unhurried and tranquil as this one could be the driver of so much speed, energy, and industry in the world I'll soon return to. Perched somewhat crookedly on the precipitous slope of one of these caffeine mountains, my main thought was, you really have to give this plant a lot of credit. In less than 1,000 years, it has managed to get itself from its evolutionary birthplace in Ethiopia all the way here to the mountains of South America and beyond, using our species as its vector. Consider all we've done on this plant's behalf. Allotted it more than 27 million acres of new habitat, assigned 25 million humans to carefully tend it, and bid up its price until it became one of the most precious crops on earth. This astounding success is owing to one of the cleverest evolutionary strategies ever chanced upon by a plant, the trick of producing a psychoactive compound that happens to fire the mind of one especially clever primate, inspiring that animal to heroic feats of industriousness, many of which ultimately redound to the benefit of the plant itself. For coffee and tea have not only benefited by gratifying human desire, as have so many other plants, but these two have also assisted in the construction of precisely the kind of civilization in which they could best thrive, a world ringed by global trade, driven by consumer capitalism, and dominated by a species who by now can barely get out of bed without their help. Of course, this all began strictly as an accident of history and biology. Remember the goats that were said to have inspired that curious herder to taste his first coffee berry? But that's how evolution works. Nature's most propitious accidents become evolutionary strategies for world domination. Who could have guessed that a secondary metabolite produced by plants to poison insects would also deliver an energizing bolt of pleasure to a human brain and then turn out to alter that brain's neurochemistry in a way that made those plants indispensable? A question arises. Which party is getting the better of the symbiotic arrangement between Homo sapiens and these two great caffeine-producing plants? We probably lack the perspective needed to judge the question impartially or to perceive how a plant we use might actually be using us. Big-brained and self-regarding primates that we are, we automatically assume we've been calling the shots with these two quote-unquote domesticated species, transporting and planting them where we choose, earning billions off them, and deploying them to gratify our needs and desires. We're in charge, we tell ourselves. But isn't that exactly what you would expect an addict to say? Sure you are. Bear in mind that caffeine has been known to produce delusions of power in the humans that consume it, and that this story of world-conquering success would read very differently had the plants themselves been able to tell it. My own relationship to caffeine remains a work in progress. I've been trying to honor the epiphany I had during my coffee trip, which is how I remember it, that there is a better way to relate to coffee than as an addict, one that would safeguard both my agency and the plant's power. So for several weeks, I drank caffeinated coffee only on Saturdays. This so dramatically improved my Saturdays that I gradually found myself slipping in a little caffeine during the week. Maybe a cup of green tea to clear out the dregs of a particularly muzzy morning, or a decaf when I wanted to treat myself to the taste of coffee. But as with so many addictions, the slope is slippery. The mind concocts elaborate arguments for the purpose of undermining its best intentions. I suspect it's probably easier to enforce an absolute ban than one that's shot through with exceptions and therefore subject to rationalization and self-deception. My latest idea is simple. To have some caffeine on Saturdays for pleasure and household chores, but also at a few select other times when I need it. Use coffee or tea as a tool, in other words, rather than let coffee and tea use me. I remember Roland Griffith telling me there had been a time in his life when he used caffeine in precisely this way, only when he had a big deadline, say, or was writing a grant. True, when he told me this, he was sipping a tall Starbucks, suggesting either that Skyping with me qualified as a special occasion or that the regime had eventually crumbled. But maybe I could sustain it. I would try. Take this morning as an example. It is not Saturday. I'm writing the last paragraphs of this story, always a fraught exercise. People talk a lot about the importance of beginnings, but endings matter too. Ideally, they should strike a bell that reverberates long after you close the book or magazine or whatever you're about to do now to turn me off, assuming you've gotten this far. But you have. I've put off writing this ending several days in a row, not sure exactly how to handle it. You'll recall I began this story in a bit of a crisis, having given up caffeine for the story, and with it my confidence in the value of what I was about to write. Eventually, I found my bearings, though, and managed to rekindle interest in the subject without the use of the subject. I had broken free of caffeine's grip, or so I like to think. This morning, however, setting out to find these last words, up against my deadline, I felt like I needed, and honestly I deserved, a little something extra to push me over the finish line. But it was only Thursday. Was this a strong enough reason to break my Saturday rule? As Judith and I walked down the hill to the cheese board this morning, I was unsure what I would order right up to the moment when I stepped to the front of the line. It was not just the barista I surprised when these words popped out of my mouth. "Make it a regular, please." The end.
This has been an Audible Originals production of Caffeine, How Caffeine Created the Modern World. Written and performed by Michael Pollan. Executive producers David Blum, Joanne Parrots, and Mike Charzik. Editorial producer Doug Stumpf. Produced and directed by Chelsea Pita. Edit, master, and sound design by Cybersound. Copyright 2019 by Michael Pollan. Sound recording copyright 2019 by Audible Originals, LLC.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.